Welcome to NPR, and thank you so much for coming. My name is Shirley Henry. I work here at NPR, obviously. I graduated from BU as an undergrad in 1992, College of Communications, and also what is now the Pardee School of Global Studies at BU. I studied communications, journalism, and international relations. I'm now the chief Washington editor here at NPR, which means I manage the team that covers the White House, the Hill, the Justice Department, and the presidential campaign. So there's a couple things going on. I'm so glad I could sneak away to just welcome you guys here tonight. I'm really glad to see you at NPR. And it's my pleasure to welcome you to this conversation tonight about investigative journalism in today's era. And I want to introduce you to our panelists and our moderator. Kevin Arita, who's in the middle here, class of 79, School of Communications, is a senior vice president at ESPN. He's also editor-in-chief of The Undefeated, a digital platform that mines the intersections of race, sports, and culture and oversees investigative and enterprise journalism at ESPN. During his tenure, the teams he oversees have won numerous prizes for journalism and innovation. Before joining ESPN in 2015, he spent 22 years at the Washington Post as a congressional correspondent, national political reporter, long-form feature writer, magazine columnist, and senior editor. That's so super impressive. Kimberiel Kelly is a graduate of Comm, 1998, deputy editor for Enterprise and Investigations in the Washington Bureau of the LA Times. She's formerly an investigative reporter at the Washington Post, where she worked with Kevin, and 20 years of experience as a reporter, editor, and publisher. In 2019, she was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, and in 2016 was part of the team that won the Pulitzer for the Post's Fatal Force series on police-involved shootings. Our moderator tonight is Somil Trivedi, BU law grad of class of 09, a senior staff attorney at the ACLU's Criminal Law Reform Project. He litigates, speaks, and writes nationwide on criminal law and constitutional law reform issues, often partnering with investigative journalists. His work has been featured in the Washington Post, the LA Times, the Marshall Project, and many other outlets. Please join me in welcoming our panelists. I think you take it away, right?
Okay, I will. Okay. Thank you, Shirley. So as Shirley just mentioned, I am not a journalist, although I did bring my notebook, my journalist notebook, to like play the part today. But I know you're here to hear from Kevin and Kimberiel, so I will get right to it. Kevin, Kimberiel, we just got a little bit of your background, but I'd love for you to give us a little more. Maybe chart your path from BU to this chair that you're sitting in today. And in particular, tell us a piece of investigative journalism, maybe yours, maybe somebody else's, that really got you hooked on the profession. And then, if one or both of you can tell us the adorable story of how you know each other, you get bonus points. So, Kevin, you want to start?
Well, I graduated. I went to Boston University in the aftermath of Watergate, and you know, journalism is a very hot profession. Helped along by, of course, Woodward and Bernstein. The real life Woodward and Bernstein, but also, you know, Dustin Hoffman and Robert Redford, you know. And, you know, but I think it did have an impact on me as far as once I got to BU. And, you know, that was the first kind of reference. I grew up in the D.C. area, and I was you know, always reading the sports pages, and that was when I first kind of like thought that there was a career. You know, I was an avid reader. I played sports, but I was an avid reader of Shirley Povich, who was a longtime sports journalist, columnist at the Washington Post for 50 years. It's, you know, ironically, when I got to the Washington Post, just as Shirley was still there. You know, he was there for 50 years. So somebody I read as a kid, essentially introduced me to journalism. I'm here working in the same place with him, which was really cool. But as it related to investigative journalism, I went, and I was in this program at after I graduated from Boston University in Berkeley, and it was kind of like a boot camp. And there was a guy by the name of Les Payne, who was a really, you know, at the time, famous, you know, investigative reporter, and had won a Pulitzer Prize for investigating the heroin trail. And he kind of like took a mentorship of me. We had brought him to Boston University, our student newspaper at one point, and Les was, you know, he had a big influence. And so my early years as a reporter, my first job was the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. I was trying to be an investigative reporter. I was trying to investigate. So it was a combination of Watergate and then Les Payne, and that's what I thought I wanted to become. And you know, probably the early, you know, I would do this work on my own. As Kimbrielle probably can tell you, you know, you didn't always, I wasn't in a position, there was no investigative reporting slot carved out for me. I was working on a city zone section as a young reporter, but in my spare time, I was trying to investigate things. And I managed to, a couple of the things early on that allowed me to do, there was a dogfighting ring. And dogfighting has been rumored, you know, to be, you know, that for a long time in lots of cities and underground kind of thing. It was popularized and brought to a lot of people's attention after Michael Vick, you know, certainly got caught and convicted and served his time and all of that. But I kind of went kind of undercover, and I was...
As a dog?
Yeah, I wish I could have, because you could see a lot from that person. But, you know, I broke this dog fighting ring open, and there was another big drug ring that was going on, and I kind of broke that story, and then that kind of led me to be able to do more of that. I ended up kind of diverting from that. That was the early beginnings, because I ended up going to the Dallas Morning News from the Milwaukee Journal, and I initially went because of some of the work I had done at the Journal. I thought I was going to be on a projects team, and I was on a projects team. But then I got diverted into political reporting because they had asked me to be part of covering a couple of local races that were important. And that diverted my path on, ended up being a local political reporter, then a national political reporter, and covering campaigns. And so for a long period of my time, just by accident, I ended up becoming a political reporter, and for a long time, that's what I did. And so I spent, you know, maybe like 10 years at the Dallas Morning News, back both in Washington and in Texas, which is a great political reporting state. And then I ended up coming back, being an editor. Then I ended up going to the Washington Post, and at the Post, as Shirley explained, I did a bunch of things for a long period of time, including initially political reporting, but I got into long-form feature writing and ended up kind of taking into the editing senior management route, and then that changed my path as a writer and reporter, and I ended up being a national editor after the Obama election. I was asked to be national editor. Ended up being national editor for a period of then, and then managing editor under Marty Baron at the time, and was there when Jeff Bezos bought it. So, you know, Kimbrielle and I, that's where our paths crossed. I didn't know she was a Boston University grad when we hired her, but that probably would have made me hire her even more. You know? But yeah, we hired Kimbrielle. It was an amazing hire for us. She can tell her own story, but she was in Chicago doing this great work, Chicago Reporter. Certainly a publication I recognize, doing a lot of great investigative work, but we were happy to hire, and then we discovered that we both were BU grads.
Top that.
I can't. I'm like, I could just listen to this all hour. So I guess... I kind of had the non-traditional approach into journalism. And I was similar to like most other journalists who worked on their school newspapers, but I wasn't the person clued in to figure out like I can make a go of this as a career. I thought it was just like a hobby, right? right? Now, this isn't what I wanted, a hobby. And so I actually went to a different school. I went to a small liberal arts college in Chicago and was getting a degree in English. And when I thought I wanted to be a lawyer. I was like, oh, like, this is like, I know. So I had my epiphany early. So like at the time, I'm totally dating myself, but like there was this show called L.A. Law. Yeah, okay, all right, great room to be in. Okay, so L.A. Law, I was like, oh, Blair Underwood, like, this is so cool. And there was this, like, curly-haired lawyer, I forgot her name, but she had, like, this, these big, bright red curls, and I was, like, noticing, like, they always, like, go home with this briefcase full of stuff if they go home. And I remember having this thought, like, is this what I really want in life? And the answer. So,
you're not triggering me, don't worry.
I probably am, but you know, you'll like feel the effects later. So I basically decided, and you know, as a junior, well, I don't know what I want to do, right? And so I went to my college career office and opened up this book. It literally was called something like, What to Do with Your Major. And it was like this big, and you open it up to English. And there are pages and pages of possible careers. And I remember my eyes landed on journalism. And then I just thought all of a sudden, like all those years working my high school newspaper, my college newspaper, you know, all those like young authors contests that I had been entering since I was like literally could pick up a pen, actually a pencil, at like 7 years old. And they were bad. I still have them. And all that, like, poetry, reading Robert Frost, because I thought it was so rhymey and cool. Like, all of a sudden, it kind of made sense. And so then the light went off. I was like, I'm going to be a journalist. I could actually make money doing this. And then I realized I don't have a degree. And that's where BU stepped in. And so I completed my English degree, and then I got accepted into the graduate program at BU. So that's what launched my journalism career. A little bit late, but eventually I got on the correct path. In terms of investigative journalism, I probably was a little bit earlier bloomer when that happened. I became an investigative reporter officially when I was 26, which I think is pretty young. Trying to do the math. Yes, I graduated in 98, so I'm 44. So I kind of worked at a publication before that. It was a daily newspaper and it was fine. But I had this affinity for math and data. I like things like checking off boxes and planning and numbers. And most journalists hate math, right? And so they wouldn't give me Microsoft Excel to do data analysis. And so they were like, that's only reserved for the senior reporter, which is not you. And I was like, okay, well, what can I do? Because I'm filing public records requests at 22, 23 years old, which was a little unusual for a reporter at that time. I'm doing data analysis, and they're like, well, you could do it on the calculator. So I essentially ended up doing data analysis on calculator for my first, like, from 22 to 26. That being said, they also offered when one of the senior writers who had the programs left for the day, I might be able to go on their computer and use it. That was the solution. But in any event, it worked out, and I ended up, to answer your question in terms of, like, who I admired, you know, this sounds really silly at the time, but there was this, does anybody know about Nellie Bly? Okay, so I've never really, I don't think, talked about this story a lot, but I just remember hearing a long time when I was younger about Nellie Bly, and that, you know, she had this pen name, which was a Nellie Bly. I don't know what her original name was. I should look that up. But basically, she had found out about the conditions of people who were mentally ill and that they were being treated poorly. And so she had this idea of investigative reporting that in order to get what the story was, she wasn't going to go talk to the experts like what we just do, but she needed to go be among the people who were experiencing this. And I remember just being really fascinated by the story. And so she basically pretended to be mentally ill to get herself committed to this mental institution so that she can write an investigative stories about that. And I just, that's always stuck to me from this very day, that I feel like there's a role and responsibility that we have to investigate institutions and things to talk about people who are disenfranchised, which led me at 26, after putting the calculator down, And in, I ended up going to the Chicago Reporter, a place that was offering me, I was actually interviewing at the time at the Washington Post too, but then things started happening in 2004, 2005, they were doing layoffs. And so the Chicago Reporter was a 40-year-old, actually at that time I think 37-year-old, investigative magazine in Chicago. It wasn't general interest, so it wasn't gonna be on the shelves of the airports or anything like that. But policymakers and lawyers very much knew this publication because they would read the investigations and write policies or effect some sort of change at it. So I started as a one-year fellow there. It was my first investigative journalism job, so I was 26, I guess 26, 27. And they gave me Microsoft Excel.
Set now.
I took like this huge pay cut to go there. I'm like, food, Excel. I'll take Microsoft Excel and Microsoft Access. Now, granted, it was the kind of Microsoft Access circa 2004 where you needed to like run your query and then go to lunch and hope that by the time you came back, it was done or either the computer had crashed, one or the other. Fortunately, we're past that right now. But I mean, that was like huge. So I ended up going there. My first investigation, actually, it was in 2004. Anybody remember when the housing crisis happened?
Yeah.
So technically, I think we all remember like January 08, but really it was like kind of December 2007. And either way, I started reporting on it in 04. I like catching trends before a trend. And I remember going out into the community, sort of like how Nellie Bly would have gone. And I went to these neighborhoods, and I was running into these people, particularly African Americans. And there was this guy. He was like, he worked for this consulting firm. And he told me the story. He's black, and he had $100,000 in the bank in his savings account. He made $100,000, over $100,000 a year at that time. And he bought a house on the south side of Chicago. And he wanted to buy the house, and it was $40,000. And he couldn't get a student loan. I mean, he couldn't get the loan approved for the house, the mortgage. And anytime I start an investigative story, I like to observe my surroundings and say, like, what's broken? Like, where is there a system where people are being harmed? Where is there a problem that's got scope? Like, a lot of people are impacted. And I remember taking that story and saying, okay, can I find some data that can kind of quantify this man's story? Because how could you make this much money, have this much money in the bank, and then not qualify for like a mortgage for $40,000? So I basically got federal mortgage data, and a long story short, I ended up reporting on this for the next 3 years before the housing crisis, and ended up writing stories showing that in Chicago, African-Americans who were getting subprime loans, who earned over $100,000, were more likely to get those subprime loans than whites earning less than $30,000 a year. And so my philosophy was, you can't just, like, you have to show the disenfranchisement and the inequitable treatment, but the Illinois Attorney General read that story and had the same reaction you guys did. And so she ended up filing suit against several of those, a couple of really big names. I won't say names, but you can Google me. And so she filed a lawsuit, which was also joined by 9 other state's attorneys, and it ended up being the largest Department of Justice fair housing settlement around subprime lending. And that's when I got recruited to come work at the Washington Post.
That's fascinating. And actually, your story just now touches on a lot of what I want to talk about today. You know, the name of this panel is The State of the Profession Today. So I want to ask about the state of the profession today. And specifically, you know, on the one hand, we've got consolidation of media companies. We've got the internet running havoc over traditional journalism and traditional media outlets. And on the other hand, there are still certain smaller investigative outlets like the Chicago Reporter or, you know, in today's case, The Undefeated or The Marshall Project that seem to be thriving. So I wanted to get your take on where you think that stands now, what the landscape looks like now, and where you think it'll shake out in 5 years or even 50 years.
Yeah, that's a big towering question.
I try.
I just looked to you, Kevin.
I think
knowing nothing about the profession helps.
No, I mean, I think that like most of the professions, most, we're all kind of living in this digital age, mm-hmm. you know, and that is shaping the change that we see in every profession, you know, and in our profession, particularly because but it's not unique to us. You're getting a product out to people who consume it. And you want people to read your work, view your work, react to it, follow it, hopefully pay for it. And so a lot of it is the work is still the work, but how do you reach people in ways that they want to be reached? Because their consumption habits have changed. And so, you know, now we, you know, I look at it like, you know, I spent most of my career in the quote-unquote newspaper business. That's the largest chunk of my career. But whether you're at a magazine or you're at a radio station or a television network, we're all digital. We're all connected because media is digital now. That's what media is. There's no real broadcast, or you can call yourself what you want to call yourself, but everybody is thinking digitally. They're operating digitally. They have digital products, and they're reaching digital consumers. And so that's really an important thing. That's because, so I think about it like, you know, just as we're talking about investigative work, there's more opportunity now because in some ways, there's been a democratization of content.
Yep.
And that's a good thing for democracy. A lot of people can create stuff. That's why we have YouTube stars and Instagram stars, and probably, I'm not on TikTok, but TikTok stars. You know, and that is because people can go out and create content for that medium, and then they can become big, and they are people driving that. Now, my thing is, like, there's no reason why there's not an investigative way to reach any of those platforms.
Yeah.
And we talk about it. I mean, I oversee investigative journalism now at ESPN, and we talk about that a lot, you know, of how can you create work in different platforms that are off the platforms you are now, like YouTube, and to reach things and with different forms and different ways. And so I think that's part of it. But one of the great things, if you're in something like investigative journalism, that it's shrinking the people who are doing the work, right? And so it does bring more responsibility, and in some ways it's more open. So some things are coming around to be a lot simpler. Like, you know, I just got through reading. I was on vacation. I got through reading She Said, which is one of the two books out about the kind of anatomy of the Harvey Weinstein and everything that happened that brought about the Me Too era that we're in, but Jodi Kantor and Megan Toohey, Megan, who I wanted to hire, but at the Post, and it's a really good kind of just look. I don't know how many people read it, of just their work.
Yeah.
And what you see is that the work takes a long time to do, and it's painstaking. And a lot of it is very simple. It's going back, trying to find people to talk to you. And getting people to talk to you is a really simple process. But now we have more tools to find. We can track people down, but then we still got to get them to talk to us. Mm-hmm. And so when you watch the work that they to get to a point to have something publishable in the New York Times on Harvey Weinstein, and then they were doing it on lots of other places, Fox News, and you know with Roger Ailes, and lots of people were the work was happening in different arenas, but just in Hollywood, on one guy who was a towering figure in Hollywood, a lot of it was knocking on doors. It's finding people, figuring out when to talk to people, how to get to people, and that is a thing that's still germane and important today as it was 50 years ago, even in the digital era. You know,
and you still got to be courageous.
Yeah,
and you face threats.
I mean, I'll say this. You know, Bob Woodward. I work with Bob Woodward. You know, at the Washington Post. I mean, I was there, and I remember doing one of the books in this that I read in college, The Brethren. And you know, I'm sure you read it. You're a lawyer, right? And I read it in college. It was one of our college assignment things, and I was really mesmerized by getting inside the Supreme Court. It's a hard institution to penetrate. I did a book with Mike Fletcher on a Supreme Court Justice, Clarence Thomas, called Supreme Discomfort. And so, of course, when we were working on this book, and Justice Thomas, very mysterious figure, I went to talk to Bob because he wrote one of the signature books about the court. And I went to talk to him and just get some advice. And his advice is very simple to me. It was just like, well, Kevin, I would go and John Paul Stevens lives in this condo mostly down in Florida. I would go down there and knock on his door. You know, I mean, it was very methodical. You know, David Souter spends a lot of time in his house in New Hampshire. It's on a hill. I go knock on his door and see him. And it was some very basic kind of things of getting to people and getting people to trust you and talk. And that's not the only thing we do, because she's a record
amazing.
Wismo's good. I just made that up. But,
I like that.
But, you know, it's there are some things that are practices that are still important today in our profession, even as we see, my mom talks about, like, and everybody talks about, really, like, you get overwhelmed with content, as they call it now, you know? That includes journalism. But it's just, Dale, you know, it's like 9 documentaries a night. People are producing stuff so quickly, it's hard to keep up with it. Because it's easier to get, and people are producing it at a rapid pace, and people are paying for it on streaming services, so they got to generate it. And so, anyway, that's a long way of saying that I think where we're going in the profession is we're still going to have some of what we have now, because it takes reporting to find out stuff people don't want you to know. Right. And that's going to always remain the same.
Ms. Wismo?
I think that particularly some of the publications that you mentioned, like the Marshall Project and my former publication, Chicago Reporter, and I would add like the Texas Tribune to that list.
Right.
And you know, there's a lot of outlets doing this kind of work. And the thing, I kind of stuck on your word thrive, and I kind of cringed a little bit, because as a person who used to run one of those nonprofits, like, I love that you believe that those places are just thriving.
Maybe it was aspirational.
Yeah. You know, maybe it is aspirational. And maybe things have changed, but I just remember running an organization like that as the publisher. I was the editor and publisher, and thinking, you know, year to year, you're wondering where your revenue is coming from. When you're working in an investigative setting like that often, and this is not a discussion that reporters usually have, but managers do, you know, your funders are looking for an outcome to your work. They want it to be measurable, right, with whether it's quantitative, qualitative data, whatever. But at the end of the year, those 12 months, they'd like to be able to justify, like, why they gave you this money. And it's very stressful. Not for reporters, per se, except for they want to know if they're going to have jobs and if they can do this great quality work that Kevin's talking about. And so I think that while they have thrived, part of that is probably also survived. And in the next 5 to 50 years, I think it's hard to kind of predict, because funders, some of them used to do like these 3-year grants, and it was like wonderful. They might say, you need to write about immigration, which is like, you're like, great, you're not being super specific. But now sometimes what you see is, and some people have written about this, is that it's like, well, we want you to write about something in this box. You know, there are kind of strings attached. Or sometimes the grant giving is only for like 1 year, maybe 2 years if you're lucky. And so I think that that adds a little extra burden, which makes the future of some of those, not those places in particular, but probably so, like a little bit more questionable. And I think you try to be nimble and say, okay, let's become a digital first publication. What can we do? Like Reveal has like the podcast, right? I think that's a perfect example. And other, you know, LA Times is doing that too. And everybody's trying to figure out what's the next thing that we can do to kind of, to compete. But I think it is still very difficult. I don't think I would say that they're all thriving, because I think that they're all still facing a lot of challenges and are probably going to increasingly so in the next 5 years even, because what you see now is this current administration is driving a lot of traffic for the media. I mean, it's just like attention. It's sucking all the air out of the room. Well, what happens when that administration eventually changes? what happens to those jobs? What happens to those nonprofits? And so I think even in the near future, that's something we need to think about more seriously, because I think those are places that have been around for a very long time, and we want to continue to have them around. And so, and they're also traditionally not places that get a lot of like individual gift giving,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so I think that that's something that people need to like keep on their radars.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I have to point out that if I knew you could just walk up to a Supreme Court justice's door and tell them what you wanted to tell them, I'd skip a lot of brief writing in my life. I wish I had gotten that tip. That's really unfortunate.
He shares them with everybody.
Yeah.
I have my Bob Woodward yeah. list, because he would actually be even more specific about what times you should go.
Well,
like, if they were drinking their afternoon, I think he said their afternoon, like, cocktail, whatever it was called, like, during that hour is, like,
yeah.
the best, because they're and you're just like, he's very methodical about this.
I'm not sure I followed Bob's exact advice, but the spirit of it I did, because we, you know, and you know, going to court, not to derail this, but doing a book on the Supreme Court was very frustrating. It was also just an amazing kind of like education for me at the time, anyway, of how anachronistic the court was. It was unlike any other institution. You can't get their public schedules, their public officials. I mean, it's just so much that they keep. It's like 9 individual law firms within that are sheltered. But the one thing we tracked we have more high level technology to find schedules, but we found schedules, and we simply went to where they were.
Yeah.
And so that's how I did it. And walked up to them and said, Justice Samil, I'm Kevin Merida.
Well, I like
and,
that.
And I you know. Doing this book,
yeah.
And so we did do that. We walked up and found every single justice.
So, Kimberielle, you mentioned 2020, and I know this is the question that folks are dreading. You mentioned that.
He's waiting to get to that 2020.
Yeah.
Which is where I recuse myself from it.
Well, so actually, I
do too.
No, you're in.
I think this one is answerable, which is that you know, this year. Like it or not, we're going to be inundated with stories about impeachment and the election, right? In many ways, it's going to drown out the conversation, for better or for worse. What is a way that investigative journalism specifically can sort of break through our bubbles and educate us in a year when people are likely to sort of decamp? How can investigative journalism play a role?
I think it's great because being an investigative reporter, it's like I get to go and write about people, right?
Yeah.
So a lot of the election is about people, but in a very different way. It's like people in power and people in money and the intersection between the two. And that's fine and good. There are a lot of people writing about that. And so what I like to do is kind of get off of that path and say, okay, well, like those powerful people, what are the policies that they made and how are they impacting people in their everyday lives? Let's investigate those things, because guess what? Those people, it's us, right? And so if, you know, we just did a story a couple months ago about toxic water and PFAS. How does that break through? It did very well for us because in the LA Times, we hadn't written about this before. And I was like a new editor. I just joined like 6 months ago. And I was like, it was my Pentagon reporter who like pitched this idea. It wasn't your quintessential Pentagon story. It wasn't about Esper and all the politics at DOD and who's the new person heading it now. I mean, it literally was about the fact that there were all these military bases across the country where they had used this firefighting foam and the chemicals had leached into wells across the country. And surprise, California had the most contaminated bases. It was like the simple story. And so I remember when the reporter brought me the story, and I was like, we got to go a step beyond for the story. This isn't just telling people, like, California has the most contaminated bases. It's like, further the story. What happened to that contamination? It went somewhere, right? It went to people. It went off base. Have they tested off base? Where have they tested off base? Can we tell people? I mean, we ran this story. It took us just like 6 weeks. I added it, and I was like, okay, would you be okay if I brought in the environmental reporter? I brought in one from LA, and I brought... asked our environmental reporter in the Washington office, and we put all of our heads together, and we came out with this quick, easy story, and all of a sudden, all these people are converting and trying to, like, get access to this story, and we were just like, this is intense, but we had never written about that. So I say that to say, in spite of all of that, I think if you focus on investigative efforts, and like I said, that was like a 6-7 week project or story. If you focus on what people care about, you know, or as I say, what I like to click into when I'm rolling over in bed in the morning and I wake up, you know, I like to think about, as I'm scrolling through my Twitter feed, like, what am I most likely to click on? Something that impacts me, what I'm about to drink. And so I think that that's something that we need to focus on. And I would say one of the really cool things last year when I found out that we were finalists for the Pulitzer, and so for the second time, I was like, yay, excited. You know, the first time we won the Pulitzer, it was under Kevin's watch, and it was for the officer-involved shootings, and it was like pre-Trump, right? And our group of folks came together afterwards when we were finalists for the second series. It was on homicides across America, unsolved homicides in the Trump era. Like, whoa! And I remember Wes Lowery and I got together and Stephen Ridge, and we said, how in the world, in spite of everything that's going on around us, this become a finalist for the Pulitzer? And we were almost more proud about that in this political climate than officer-involved shootings, because Wes said, if we had done officer-involved shootings that same year, we don't know what would have happened if it would have won the Pulitzer. But it's like, that impacted people. It didn't matter if you lived in those neighborhoods or not. The fact that we had said that half of these murders go unsolved in America, you're like, wait, what? And we had the maps and everything. And so those were two different projects in two different eras, both that were meaningful to people. But you just have to continue to focus on how is my audience going to understand your audience, write good stories. I know Kevin used to say that all the time. He's a great wordsmith and loves storytelling. And he's one of those huge advocates in like a newsroom for that. But it's like people want to hear good stories that make us feel human again and also that resonate with us.
Which, by the way, we're taught as lawyers every day, is to turn, seriously, to turn our legalese into human stories. And it's a really difficult skill. So I'm glad you're saying that.
Well, no, I think she said it pretty well. I mean, I think, you know, you, in the context of a campaign coverage is so long. And it's, you know, I think there are questions. You know, what are the questions that people want to know, to have answered? And that's a good place to begin with investigative reporting. What are big questions that voters have that you need to bring some deeper, more penetrating reporting answer? And it's just kind of old-fashioned accountability reporting. Candidates are out presenting themselves as this and that, and what they would do, and their backgrounds, and what they have done. And you want to interrogate that, you know, and that's where the investigative reporting come in, to see if they are who they say they are, or if they've done what they said they did. And that's a basic kind of foundation of kind of investigative reporting campaigns. You're trying to give people who are going to be voting a clean shot at the truth about the people who might want to be president. I think, you know, there's always, you know, that's not a specific story, but it's kind of a construct, you know, yeah, that's important in campaigns. And it's the accountability function of journalism that's one of the most important, I think.
Yeah. So I want to leave time for questions, but I'm going to ask one last question of you. Hopefully we can make it an uplifting one, which is, because, you know, who wants to end
on
election?
We're uplifted just being with you, Samir.
Oh, I appreciate that. So what can we, as consumers of investigative journalism, as potential investigative journalists ourselves, do to support the profession, aside, of course, from paying for it?
Well, that's it.
Yeah. I know it's a big one.
You know, I would say, yes, subscribe. You know, but also, like, I love tips. Like, one of the things that I love about working with, I have a team of 5 investigative reporters. They cover, like, the immigration, Pentagon, immigration, Pentagon, the environment, all sorts of things. But, you know, whenever they bring a story idea to me, one of the first questions I ask them is, where'd you get this idea? If, you know, that the answer was like, oh, an editor told me, wrong.
Don't want to hear
any of that. But if they say, like, you know, I got this tip. you know, that is like music to my ears. And I feel like, you know, even when we worked on our homicide series, before I left to go to the LA Times, like a friend of mine at the Post said that that series wouldn't have been the same without this narrative that I had done on this woman who had four kids, and three of the four kids were murdered over disparate periods of time and different moments in time. But it's the storytelling, and but she had responded to a call out, and it was just like an email that could have gone like unnoticed, but it wasn't. And so I would say, like, if you have tips, if you know reporters, like, people need to get reporters are way more accessible than people actually. Okay, maybe not the political reporters, like now or this week, but or today. But they're highly accessible, and when you actually call them with like a legitimate like tip, and they want to talk to you about it, and those are like the best ideas. So, you know, support journalism with your, you know, your finances and resources, but also with your tips and ideas.
That's fantastic.
You know, I'm always inspired by the work that is done all around the country in different places, and you know, I think there's an impression because the big places always get the most attention when the Post does something, the Times does something. But there's great work. I have been, you know, been privileged to be a judge, a juror, as they call on a number of the juries at judging the Pulitzer and among other contests. But that particularly because it's kind of like the prestige prize in our profession. And the thing that you learn is that there is good work being done everywhere. And I've been on some juries where it felt good that we were, you know, sending up for the final vote, or here's three finalists, and they're from small places that don't have all the resources that I have at the Post. And, you know, and one I was, you know, I can't remember them all, but I was thinking of, you know, opioid crisis has become a really big crisis, but a lot of that reporting that was done, that people picked up on, was done in a small place, like the Gazette Mail in Charleston, West Virginia, which won a Pulitzer a couple years ago, for really exposing that at the highest rate of deaths in the country, you know, something like 1,700.
Yeah.
You know,
narrowing it down to that one
years.
Pharmacy that had that.
Yeah. And it's like they and when you're doing that work in those small places to expose that, you're taking on a lot of difficulty, not only the institution, the business, but the community, because you're basically saying we have some broken things in the community, and so you're going up against the grain of so much, and sometimes we're not the huge resources. So always, that's always inspiring to me, you know, and that's a lot of that work is being done. So it means that, you know, the profession has really extended, because a lot of times we kind of focus on the loss, and there has been a lot of loss, you know, no city hall reporters and some big city, no state house reporters in major places, a lot of drying up newspapers, but there still manages to be this profession, you know, in places like, you know, Charleston, West Virginia, doing great work.
That's inspiring to hear. So I want to get to some questions, but first, how about a round of applause for Kevin and Kimberly? Okay, who wants to be an investigative journalist?
In today's era, which is the topic, we have a president who is constantly calling news fake news, or, you know, enemy of people, what have you. How does that affect investigative journalism? Do people believe what you're reporting?
So this goes to
Wizmo.
This goes to my Wizmo in me. So I feel like we were dealing with this to some extent even before Trump was elected. Like, you can present people with facts and it's still a challenge, right? Especially in investigative reporting. I mean, Watergate. I mean, so I feel like the thing that I've always focused on is data analysis and public records. If you have the facts, when you have the data, particularly if you got it from the agency that you will probably expect will be challenging you, you know, it's kind of hard to refute things. And so I feel like if you focus on, and I do data analysis, I actually teach part-time at American University Quantitative Methods also. So I'm kind of a big data geek. I wear the nerdy t-shirts and all. But I feel like if you support in your research that with a lot of documents, huge document trail, and with a lot of analysis. And you get people to fully explain that from both sides. Like, I think sometimes in daily reporting, some people can just put in a no comment because you're rushed and you have, when you're doing investigative reporting, you have to get the other side. Your story would be completely out of balance. And so because you have more time, you have more room to fill in the gaps. And so you actually get both sides. So it's almost impossible for somebody to come up and say that that was like fake or not true because you've kind of like buffered your reporting. And so I think that that's important. And like the perfect example about, you know, Chicago, it's like the 100,000, you know, for people who are black versus white. It's like there was going to be no way to tell that story anecdotally where people be like, nah, that's not true. They just picked an outlier. When you show numbers from the federal government, from the FFIEC, I mean, it was really hard to argue that. And I think that that's why it ultimately ended up the way it did. And so for me, that's the way I tell my reporters, and I've had these conversations recently, like you need to, like, what data skills are you trying to improve? What public record skills are you trying to improve? When you get told no, what are your avenues for appeal? What are your possibilities for litigation? You don't have any money for litigation? Well, then you need to get better at negotiation. You need to get better at appeals. What's your timeline? And being able to just really strengthen your data and documents and spend time with people, understanding that people's, like, you have to get perspectives on all sides of the universe. When I was talking to police departments for the officer-involved shootings, but also for the homicides, people couldn't believe, they're like, how are police chiefs talking to you guys after you, like, basically beat up on them with the Fatal Four series?
Yeah.
Like, people couldn't believe I then came back with another series, fired, rehired, and then on homicides, they're like, why are the police departments keep talking to you? Because you also build a reputation. You know, they may say, like, oh, that's fake news or whatever. But deep down, when you actually start talking to them and writing about that and building your reputation, like, the facts are the facts.
Yeah. Hi, college communication class, and I'm due. Building on what you said, actually, this was the thing that brought me here tonight. I feel like there's such an echo chamber effect with the internet. And, you know, I went to college communication, we talk about journalistic standards and so forth, and it just seems like it doesn't even matter anymore in today's world with the echo chamber. They're going to ignore the fact that you have done all your homework and crossed every T and dotted every I. And how do we deal with that? Because it just seems like, it's a real challenge when you have an electorate that is only listening to one side of the story, and they're not supporting all the work that you do to show that you're legitimate is being ignored.
Yeah, I think though it's a larger societal problem, and it gets back to the kind of times, you know. So what I was talking about before about the democratization of content, anybody can construct a media platform, a site, they can have a stream, a thread, they can create their own, subreddit. You know, people have a way to just pitch to the audience that has them. That we have a segmented society, and if you live in that world and you only want, if you only want things of a certain ideology, or if you only want sports, you can live there and never have to touch anything else. You know, the world will go pass you by, and I just think that we've created the ability to it, and a lot of people live in that world. I'm not sure we're going to change minds and change that, right? Like, so, you know, those who really want to just ignore and get, you know, because there's always somebody that's going to counter something and say, well, here are some facts. Don't believe what the LA Times published. Don't believe what the Washington Post. Don't believe. Look at this. And so I just think it means that hopefully that there are enough. The good thing is that there are enough ways to, you can get the real information. And if enough people get it, it refutes it. And so, you've presented like the challenge of our times, right? Like, And some of it is, to me, it's the more dangerous part about it is it's not just people who want to believe what they want to believe. It's people who are actively creating false information and presenting it in a package, and they're getting that out into the stream. And I think that, you know, the bots and the various ways in which people are constructing, it's like reminds you like of The Sting, you know? That was one of my favorite movies. Anybody see The Sting?
Yeah.
It was a fantastic movie, you know? And they constructed a false reality that looked real, but it was not. And so, you know, I don't know how to answer that question any better than that. It, you know, I do think for us as journalists, people who are doing that work, we just have to kind of stay focused and keep doing that work and keep trying to amplify it and penetrate.
So first of all, thank you so much. As a fellow editor of my high school newspaper,
all right.
What an honor to be in front of you. I appreciate the questions and your strategizing of how to face the lack of a common truth-telling mechanism, but I wanted to concentrate more on your personal life, perhaps, if you're available to talk about that. Investigative journalism today has been, you know, it has always been something that's dangerous. We've seen it in Malta, in the Czech Republic. You know, your family members, your loved ones are at risk. How did you deal with that from a, you know, personal network perspective?
This is interesting. Also, since I'm a woman, I think this it'll be interesting to hear your answer too. For me, most of my reporting has been domestic. But you know, a lot of the tragedies that our fellow journalists face across the globe are, I mean, immense. I mean, you see, are murdered, tortured. I mean, just so many tragedies. And so that's very scary. You know, I was in traveling last week to LA, and then I went down to San Diego, and we went to Tijuana for a tour of the area when I was visiting our home base. And one of the reporters who was with me, it was two reporters and an editor, and she was like, oh, I haven't been back to Tijuana in a while because there's a case by the FBI against this guy who's threatening to murder me. And you just are just like, wow. And it becomes so matter of fact in a very scary way sometimes because you just want to do your job. And this was a reality, like, and this person was mentally ill, and he's on the FBI watch list, but they can't really do anything, and the FBI, whoops, sorry, had an evening news meeting. but it is a reality. And so for me, for domestically, I feel like there are different sets of issues than abroad, but domestically, I know in working on the homicide series, before I left the post was interesting because it was essentially a year worth of traveling across the country, going to not only the most violent places in the US, I was on a plane when I came to this realization, I'm going to the most violent places where the murders are not solved.
And you're angering cops over it.
Yes, for 3 years, yeah. I'd been angering cops. And I remember being on the plane going, what am I doing? But at some point, you become like a robot, and you just do it. And the question of protecting yourselves, I mean, I think for reporters, they don't, you know, sometimes we're like, we don't need protection. And it's our editors, fortunately, who save us from ourselves. And my editors, like, I remember I was going to Chicago one day, and I was like, I'm from Chicago, I'm fine. And he was, like, completely panicked because I was like, oh, wouldn't it be cool going to, like, the neighborhood that has, like, the lowest police homicide closure rate, which I think was like it was 8%, right? This like little four block area. I was like, man, if I'm gonna illustrate this story in Chicago, it's gonna be it. It's gonna be that mom who was like out being detective and she lives in this neighborhood. And so for every argument that some person is gonna say, this is fake or these are bad neighborhoods, or that, you know, this kid was a thug or XYZ. I'm gonna put you in the shoes of this woman whose kid was like a fine student, you know, his teachers loved him, but it wasn't gonna be about that. It was about the effort. When people say, why don't you just cooperate for police? When you are facing a 92% open rate for homicides, you be that woman and that those people in that neighborhood who say, oh yes, I'm gonna be the one who's gonna cooperate with police. And to put people in her shoes, And so for me, I'm just like, okay, I'm going to fly in. I'm going to go there for a couple days. And then I was flying in at night, and my husband is just like, why are you going there at night? Why are you going by yourself? Like, my husband just had all these whys. Like, why are you even? And I was just like, had no good answer. I'm like, I just got to get the story. I'm going to get in. I'm from Chicago. Don't worry. I'll be fine. Blah. And then my boss started asking the same questions. Why are you going by yourself? Why are you going there at night? And so I think when I heard those questions over and over again, I was like, okay, maybe I need to modify my plan a little bit. And so I kind of did, and I agreed to having a photographer, which was the solution, like, go with me. And so I feel like you should have those conversations with people who are your bosses to help keep you safe and secure. And there's training that the Post does if you're, like, going to combat zones or war zones, and just being very, like, I mean, it's dangerous. It is, and bad things could happen, but just try to be smart about it.
Yeah, I mean, I you know, I don't have a lot of personal experience other than the normal threats and things that
see, normal,
get, totally normal. You know,
totally normal.
But I mean, I think that, you know, as a manager, for sure. I mean, that's where editors and managers are supposed to look out, because reporters, you know, have a lot of, you know, kind of like, you know, swashbuckling type of. So I think they can go into any situation and handle themselves, and generally they are. But you know, you need. Sometimes you need assessments. I mean, and certainly when I was, you know, managing editor at the Post, we had a lot of situations, you know, with foreign reporters making decisions whether to let, you know, a correspondent, you know, cross into Syria and assessing it. And, you know, I was there when we had Jason Rezaian, you know, who was in prison, you know, in a very difficult situation and, you know, not knowing what was going to be the outcome. And fortunately, he got out, but you know, reporters get kidnapped. So we, you know, there's certainly we're fortunate in terms of press freedom that we don't have quite the conditions in some other places in Mexico. The cartels take matters into their own hands. But still, you know, you report on the cartels, you're an American reporter. You can be in the same situation, and it happens a lot abroad. I think in this country, it's being safe. You're being smart, right? Like, don't go in at night. Don't go in situations. Assess everything. Get advice. You know, at ESPN, we have a security team. The head of security is a former FBI, top official FBI, and that's it's pretty much of a practice that, you know, when we're in any possible potential dangerous situation, we run things by, you know, Mike, and they give us some assessments, you know. And so sometimes, you know, you can get assessments of whether or not there is any extra danger that you may not know about. And so that's always useful.
So let's do one more. Yeah, thanks. Yeah.
So my name is Gina Fizik. I just want to underscore my question with gratitude and thank you both for making yourselves available tonight and sharing your stories. I'm a senior comms associate at an advancement project. And I did my degree at BU in 2015, but my question for you both is how doing your journalism degrees in a city like Boston that has such a fierce political and racial history, how that informs your political and racial analyses in your investigative reporting.
It's a small one to end on.
Look, I mean, I went to Boston during the late 70s, you know, and, you know, I went to Boston the first year after busing. It was probably, I was there in the most racially tense time in Boston, and I was a student, and, you know, I went there. I think my mom and others questioned, well, why are you going to Boston? You know, they saw the news and stuff, and but when you got there, initially, you know, you're in Boston University, you're on campus, and but once you go out into the city, you're just a regular person, you know. You don't have any of that kind of sense of a safe zone, and a lot of stuff happened to me during the time. And we had rocks and bottles thrown at us. You know, I was out at you couldn't go if you're a black student. You couldn't go or anybody. No one went to Fenway Park. I live not even far from Fenway Park. It was just a really dangerous, tense period. And I remember being a summer at the Boston Globe and an intern, and during a racial tension, when someone, a black student, had been killed on the trolley track, like literally, and sometimes would leave it late at night, and you're in that close thing towards South Boston. South Boston was, there was nothing, you know, equanimical about South Boston at the time. You know, it was just, that was like a dividing zone. So, so anyway, it was just like, it did have, it affect my consciousness of being black. I mean, in the sense of really being, and from a reporting standpoint, just really paying attention. You know, it, it probably sharpened my, that skill. And that, that is always a good skill, to always kind of be aware of your surroundings when you're reporting. Not, not reporting like I'm interviewing people, but just knowing where you are, being, you know, in an assessment. And so I definitely honed that at the very beginning in Boston, because I was in a lot of situations where just, you know, I didn't know where the danger was going to come. You know, Boston's a lot different now, you know, and I do, even though I had that really searing experience there from a, from that standpoint, I have a lot of, like, love for the city and what, and the things that it is, and it's the vibrancy of Boston, and small enough and cultured. But I gotta say, you know, it, it really was like a life-changing experience for me, just both being a student, and particularly once I got out and I was doing reporting and stuff in the city and doing other stuff.
I think for me, you know, living in Boston and then also in Chicago, one of the, I have like this five criteria of what makes a good investigative like project. Like in my head, I'm always, there's like two extras too. And I'm always like running through this. It's like, is the story unique? What's the broken system? Is there harm? Is there scope? Is there the potential for impact? And then the extra two is like, you know, is there, you know, a bad guy? Are there damning documents? And so like I'm constantly running through this in my head. And so I think the same was true when I lived in, you know, Chicago, which was considered like the most segregated city in the country. And then you have the issues of Boston, which weren't as extreme as when Kevin was there, but still had its, you know, reputation to contend with. And obviously, racism doesn't just disappear. And so one of the things I like is that broken system criteria. I like, you know, as investigative reporters, we're observers and everything. Like, you just sit in a room and just watch. And Anne Hull is, like, one of my favorite writers, because she gives these tips. She's like, if you're a reporter, like, go to an event an hour early, like the interview, and just write notes. Like, don't do anything but just sit there and write in your notepad. And like 99% of that stuff is not going to go in your story. But what ends up happening is you see things when you go back to your notepad that you didn't see before, that were like right in front of your face. And she used to say, also take pictures on these like disposable cameras, which aren't a thing anymore. But right, laugh at me. So I would take these pictures and I would put them up in my cube as I wrote. And now they're digital, so I'll just have them cycling through on my camera. And I write from those things, because guess what? You see what you didn't see before. You miss it because you're trying to like think through the story. What's the next question? And most of your story, all of a sudden, you're pulling out this detail. And so I think that the same thing goes true with these cities that have this very complex history with race and racism and redlining, you know, particularly Chicago. And it's like, what's the broken system that you see? What are the observations? And then keep a collection of those, because those are your stories. Like, those aren't just observations. Those are something that are it's something seeking a solution. And I feel like a lot of the stories that I've written, if you look at the course of my history over the last 20 years, have been stories that have illuminated something that people may have been walking by every day and you just didn't see.
Okay, well, with that, I think we've got to close. But one more round of applause for our panelists. And I think we get to hang out till 8:30 and talk to them in the, not sitting up here in these fancy chairs. So thank you so much.
Hey, thank you.